we'll go over to Deirdre Purcell for It Says in the Papers.
The front page of the Irish Times showcases a picture of the recently appointed Justice Minister, Frances Fitzgerald, as she speaks to the media after the publication of that independent report into her department. We're told of her commitment to implement a comprehensive programme for change, strengthening leadership, management and oversight of external agencies. The Irish Independent and Irish Examiner also lead with that story. One of the angles for the Independent is the report's recommendation that the Department of Justice be divided in two, Justice and Home Affairs, while the Examiner's take is that the Department Secretary General Brian Purcell will keep his salary as he moves sideways within the public service. The imprisoning of Ivor Callaly provides the lead for the Irish Daily Star, Irish Sun and Irish Daily Mail, while the Irish Daily Mirror leads with the tragic deaths of two experienced Irish climbers, Colm Ennis from Waterford and Peter Britton from Clonmel, who died while descending from the summit of a mountain peak in the Mont Blanc region of the French Alps. And although coverage of the crisis in Gaza has come off the front pages, the headline over the latest story in the World News page of The Independent is stark. Children sent to playground to escape Gaza attacks, cut to pieces in strike from the sky. In the same pages, we're told that France has offered asylum to the thousands of Christians who've been driven from their homes in Iraq by threats from the Islamist State jihadist group, currently in action in the country. In Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, which they now control, they had painted the letter N for Nazarene on the houses of known Christians. Back home, the Times tells us that the state has made an application to Clonmel District Court to move the forthcoming trial involving Tipperary North TD Michael Lowry to Dublin, claiming that a Tipperary jury could be biased. And electricity bills here are to rise as the green energy levy is increased by 50%. This means that irrespective of how much electricity used in a household, the annual levy will now be €73, including VAT. That's in The Independent. UNESCO's World Heritage Centre has now made inquiries about state authorisation for filming on Skellig Michael for the new Star Wars film. The island is now a temporary exclusion zone patrolled by the Irish Navy ship. And while the Irish Film Board has said that the filming schedule has been designed specifically to avoid disturbance of breeding birds on the island, Birdwatch Ireland intends to pursue the matter with the European Commission. A senior conservation officer for seabirds from Birdwatch said he couldn't see how this could be possible in the middle of the breeding season. Lorna Siggins wrote the story for The Times. And in the context of breeding, the owners of the Southern County Fishing and Family Resort, a wildlife centre on Patrick Foley's farm in County Carlow, were surprised to find a new arrival on their premises. She's a jaurizo, product of a male llama and a female alpaca. They hadn't known the alpaca was pregnant and were somewhat taken aback when this little black head popped up from the grass. That's in The Independent. Pictures of the day have to be the pair taken by Mark O'Sullivan and featured in The Times and The Examiner. From different angles, we see Stephen O'Leary from Fermoy carrying a tin helmet over his representation of a British Army World War I uniform jacket. For The Times, he kneels in front of the Tree of Remembrance, part of an exhibition to mark the centenary of the First World War at St Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. For The Examiner, with the tree behind him, he stands beside Irish wolfhound Donal, the regimental mascot of the 1st Battalion of the Irish Guards. And finally, from the Stranger Than Fiction department, we read in the Mulcahy column for The Independent that two small-time ticket touts approached two men on a Dublin street in an effort to flog black market tickets to a concert featuring the Irish rock band Codaline. The problem was, there was no concert, a fact pretty well known by the two targets for the scam, Steve Garrigan and Mark Prendergast, frontman and bass player in the band.
Fantastic. Deirdre, thank you very much. The Department of Justice is looking for a new Secretary General this morning following a report which found that it had significant leadership and management problems. The independent review group, which was set up following the Garda whistleblower controversy, found that the department had a closed, secretive and silo-driven culture. Well, with us are Eddie Malloy, who's a management consultant and director of Advanced Organisation, and also here Richard Moore. He's a former press advisor at the Department of Justice. You're both welcome to the programme. Eddie Malloy, in one way, we've been here before. Almost 20 years ago, you conducted a report and you made recommendations about the Department of Justice.
Yes, it's interesting. One of your colleagues quoted from the report last night, and it's almost the same report. We used words like nothing short of a radical transformation of the Department of Justice, its structures, its culture, its systems, its management, etc., was needed. And here we are, I think it's 18 years later, with the same story. And in a way, there's nothing unusual about that. There's a long history of reports being produced. You have a flurry of activity. You have somebody appointed, as there was then. There was a man, I think, called Kelly, brought in from another department. And these things are usually not well resourced. And after a while, the empire strikes back and the status quo ante prevails.
And by then, the public focus
has gone off it, yeah.
What's your assessment of this report?
I think this is the best report of its kind I've ever seen. And I think it's it reflects both the competence and the independence of the people who did it. You have people like Kathleen O'Toole on it, for example, who was actually the Garda inspector here for a number of years, who would know the Garda's inside out. I think that its recommendations are absolutely comprehensive. They've missed nothing. And it's, it spells it out, what's needed for a root and branch. And the other thing that strikes me is, if I were the Taoiseach or whoever's responsible, the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, I would require every department to have a similarly penetrating report done. Because I think other departments, such as Environment, for example, who oversaw all the planning corruption, building, breach of building regulations, a whole lot of stuff. Maybe not as toxic as the Department of Justice, but nevertheless, it would be a good day's work if you had a similar report done on other departments.
Richard Moore, let's bring you in on this. You worked in the Department of Justice. You were a press advisor to Dermot Ahern. What's your assessment of that department? How did you find it, so to speak?
Well, I have to say, I read the report twice last night. It's a very comprehensive report. It's pretty, in the face of it, it's pretty damning. I have to say, I didn't recognise the department I worked in from reading the report. I found the senior management in the Department of Justice and middle-ranking management and the foot soldiers, for want of a better word, I found them great people to work with. I found them excellent in the crisis. I found they had a can-do attitude, and it is by its nature, I think I said in a previous programme, it is box office. It is going to be in the front of the public because of the areas it covers. But I found it quick to react, quick to bring in legislation. I'll give you one classic example. It's a very sad example. When Roy Collins was shot in Limerick in 2009, it was a very emotional issue for the people of Limerick. But that actually threw down the gauntlet to the Irish state, where you actually had an individual shot after a court case, and there was a criminal gang involved, and it was obviously came up 2 weeks ago. The criminal gang involved waited 5 years to shoot a witness in a criminal case. That absolutely threw down the gauntlet to the Irish state, and the minister at the time, whom I worked for, Dermot Ahern, and his senior officials acted within a matter of 3 or 4 weeks and brought in anti-gang legislation. So, as I say, the report is very comprehensive, but it's not the department I would have known.
Isn't it clear, though, that there are problems? There must be problems. I mean, the reason we have this report is because of the Garda whistleblower controversy, mm-hmm. where clearly things did go wrong.
Yeah, well, the issue of the Garda whistleblower, I have to say, I can't understand. And in fairness, different ministers operate differently. I remember looking at that. I remember watching the coverage of that over a period of, it was 2 to 3 months, and I couldn't understand why the issue wasn't parked, sorted out, and the commissioner, the then commissioner Martin Callanan, shouldn't have used the word he used, disgusting. He should have withdrawn that. I think the then minister Alan Shatter should have gone before the Oireachtas and withdrew his comments that he made in relation to the whistleblowers. The issue should have been, it was very, very badly managed, in the sense that, as from a news management point of view, but also obviously internally, because the issue was allowed fester. And once you allow something like that fester, it's going to eventually implode in people's faces. And that's
actually
what happened.
It was badly managed as well from the point of view of the two Gardaí, the two whistleblowers. I mean, they were badly treated.
Absolutely. If you look at the reports, I think what happened was they weren't necessarily believed, or they were seen as, I suppose, as cranks. But they had had legitimate complaints, and they should have been addressed, and they weren't addressed. But I think the issues could have been tackled way back in February. It was allowed just fester on the vine, and I just thought it was a very badly managed from that perspective.
Is there a problem across the civil service, Eddie Molloy, where the wagons tend to be circled, or is this something that actually happens in all big organisations, that there's a resistance to change, and that if anything happens, if anything goes wrong, there's this attempt to repel any criticism?
Yes, the answer is yes, there is that tendency. But before going on to that, I would say that to say that it's not, reading the report is not the department that was there 2 or 3 years ago, whenever we were working there. I mean, Mr. Purcell inherited a culture that goes way back, and that you've already quoted from a report that myself and Sean Cremeen did in 1996. And to say that the department was very good, very quick to react, can do, etc., that's not the same as good governance. Senior management are hired and paid to set direction, to hold agencies to account, to plan, to have good systems, to have good morale, to discipline and all the other things. That's not the same as being quick on the draw if there's a crisis. And they would pride themselves in that, but that is not the same as good governance and good management.
So you're saying we're talking apples and oranges here to one extent?
Absolutely. Somebody once said to me, if to shoot the crocodiles and drain the swamp. I mean, the draining of the swamp is one of the big jobs for very senior people. It takes long-term thinking and strategic thinking. And that's spelt out in detail in this report, that was a big missing piece. And holding agencies to account, being over-deferential, for example, to agencies. That's a common thing across the civil service. It was mentioned in the Department of Finance reports, being too timid, not bringing issues to the minister, being deferential, and so on. So that comes also part of the
culture. And in this case,
the
finding is that the department was overly deferential towards the Gardaí.
To Gardaí, yes. And that's very typical, very common. I've come across it in the Department of Health and other departments. So there are lessons for the wider civil service. I think there are lessons, questions here for the top level appointments commission process, which continues to somehow promote people into senior positions in the Department of Justice, where this culture is locked in and is sustained over time and passed on to the next generation.
Richard Moore, was there simply too much going on within the Department of Justice? Because over the past few years, it appears to have gathered more and more responsibility when it already had a lot going on.
Well, the issue of a department like Department of Justice, but it's true across about other departments. And by the way, I take Eddie's point about my area was very much media management, so therefore I wouldn't be necessarily across some of the minutiae of how government departments work. But from that perspective, but coming back to the point, I mean, politicians of every hue have an awful habit of listening to certain buzzwords at election times and then deciding that, well, we need to recalibrate a government department, so we'll take a bit of this and we'll take a bit of that and we'll stick it all together. I mean, there was a classic one in 2002 when the Department of Communications, Marine and Natural Resources was cobbled together by the then, I think it was Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. I remember it took about a year, because I worked on that department, it took about a year and a half for them to bed together. They were across a whole, about 6 or 7 or 10 different buildings. So it's in fairness to the senior management of government departments, when you couple things together like that, it takes a lot of management structure to be able to bed them down. The other issue I'd say is that, and what shouldn't be lost in this thing, because I've come across from both my time in justice and since then, where a lot of government departments have had massive corporate loss, in terms of their middle ranking and senior management, they've all left. So you have a loss of corporate memory. Now, in fairness to this report that we're discussing, that it actually points to that. It says that, you know, you've lost an awful lot of corporate and middle management memory, and how did we do things before and this kind of thing. So I think there are extenuating circumstances in relation to the Department of Justice and particularly other departments as well.
Eddie Molloy, we've already heard that you were down this road almost 20 years ago, and that very little, if anything, changed afterwards. What would you like to see happening now?
Well, a couple of things that are recommended. First of all, the recommendations of the report are tremendous. They're comprehensive, etc. Now, as I said, we've seen before these kinds of reports, but implementation is the problem. Now, they're going to get a new Secretary General. And the report has wisely said, but not just one man going in. Because if one man goes in, they will close ranks and they'll see him off the premises. They'll render him ineffective, just as they did with GSOC and with the Garda Inspectorate and all the other institutions put in place.
So what do you do then?
So they've recommended that another 4 to 6 people be added, if you like, to the senior team from outside. That's very important. And I can't give you a short answer, but there are one or two textbook, again, exemplary cases of institutional reform of the level and depth that's needed here. One is the RUC. And that requires things like very strong oversight bodies. So, for instance, the team that's done this report has volunteered to act as an oversight body.
And do you think that that's important that they are kept in place?
They're kept in place. They've said they will meet every 6 months. I'd like to see them meet every 3 months to keep their feet to the fire, if you like, so that they can begin to see execution. They need the air cover of that body. And then you're looking at new blood coming in, not just one or two people. And
should these come from outside the civil service, do you believe?
No, I think there are people, for example, in other parts of the service, such as revenue, for example, who would have something of the kind of background that's needed in some of the areas covered by the guards. I think that if you look at some of the areas the guards do cover, like disability, refugees and asylum seekers, you'd wonder why the Department of Justice, rather, is handling those. And I think there can be people brought in familiar with those areas. But new blood, serious resources put behind the execution with a programme office, regular reporting, public reporting. They're the kinds of things. So we have the textbook a case with the RUC. It can be done, but if it's half done, as I said, it will revert to type in a matter of 6 to 8 months.
Just finally to you then, Richard Moore, you know how government works. You were involved with a number of departments. Do you think that there will be change?
Well, obviously there's no question there will be change. One of the issues that's in the report is the thing that it's a secretive organisation. I mean, like, let's not forget, it's the Department of Justice we're dealing with here. It's basically involved in national security, ensuring that we can implement laws, that the guards are properly run, that the prisons are run, that, in other words, that it's in a sense safe to walk the streets. So by the nature of that, it deals with issues which go to the fundamentals of the actual protection of society. So you're not dealing with the Department of Arts, Culture and Gaeltacht, with all due respects to our friends
in the Department of Arts, Culture and Gaeltacht.
I think you will see significant changes, but I think one of the issues they'll have to tackle, it's the issue of maybe middle management and the kind of brain drain, the departure of some key people because of, I suppose, what's happened in the economy over the last 10 years, you know.
All right. Well, listen, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Eddie Malloy there and also Richard Moore.
Returning to Gaza, last night the Israeli bombardment was said to be the heaviest of the 22 days so far in the conflict. Earlier, the Israeli Prime Minister had warned of a lengthy campaign. The portents for an extended conflict are very bad indeed, with the killing of at least 8 children in a playground in Gaza City yesterday. Meanwhile, this morning, Iran has called on the Islamic world to arm Palestinians. Paul Mason of Channel 4 News is in Gaza. He told me earlier about the aftermath of that attack on that playground, a warning some of his description may make for distressing listening.
I was at the Shifa Hospital. We'd just been there, actually, filming people giving presents to injured children, and we got a call that Shifa had been hit. So we rushed back, and indeed, the outside wall of the hospital garden had been blown up by something. So we rushed in to the triage area of the hospital, which was in pandemonium, and it was pretty clear by the size of the bundles that people were unwrapping that these were children. This is easier to do on radio than it is on TV, I'm afraid, because there were children with injuries consistent with blast wounds, basically, bits of them missing and not very nice. So it took a few minutes to establish that all of the dead children, I saw 4, there were apparently 8, had been killed by another attack, which was on the beach camp, which is a Palestinian refugee camp about a kilometer away. So that's what I saw, grieving relatives. And we did interview one guy who told us he'd seen it. He'd actually lost part of his clothing in the blast. He was covered in blood. He said that the the missile or whatever it was that hit the a structure then collapsed the structure, and the children were playing beneath it.
Almost immediately after that event, Hamas, of course, blamed Israel. Israel denied the attack and blamed a misfired Hamas rocket. Is that the same debate that goes on inside Gaza? In other words, are you able to ascertain what was behind that attack?
Well, nobody's been able to ascertain. I slightly kicked myself because if I would have been able to pick up fragments of the thing that hit the hospital, it would have been pretty clear whether it was an Israeli drone strike, which is what the hospital thought it was, or whether it was a rocket gone wrong. Well, it's entirely possible for a rocket to go wrong, and for two rockets to go wrong in the exact same way and land 1 kilometre apart at the same time is equally possible. Well, it's possible, but I think that the statistical likelihood of it happening is low. But then again, why would the Israelis hit the central hospital of Gaza City? We have to unpick these things, and unfortunately to say, the tragic those children's deaths were, overnight more people have been killed on both sides, and so the story has moved, as it were.
And indeed, more children. How do you read what the Israeli Prime Minister said yesterday, preparing Israelis for what he says was going to be a lengthy campaign? Israel, of course, is losing more and more troops in this ground offensive. It seems to be quite heavily invested in terms of loss of life, if that's not an inappropriate way of describing it, in if you like, reaching the end game, reaching the conclusion of what it wants to do, which is obviously
The new development this morning is what happened overnight. I mean, we have just lived through the Israeli version of shock and awe. Now, the targets that they've taken out in airstrikes, which lasted the whole night, were Hamas strategic targets. So the finance ministry, this is now a country with no treasury. So they've taken out the mayor of Gaza City's home. They took out the main TV station that supports Hamas. They hijacked the radio system and started telling people that, you know, watch out. I have yet to get a better translation than that. We've heard that they're asking people to leave parts of Gaza City. But, on top of all that, for most of the night, they were firing these big orange military flares. Now, anybody in the Irish military will know that flares can be fired, but these are flares that explode with such an impact that there is concussion felt on the ground. And these are about one a minute. So that's the awe bit of it. I mean, in a sense that they're not designed to kill people. One did float down and set fire to a school, and there were some casualties because of that. But, you know, the net effect on, remembering that 64% of the population of this place is under 16 years old, the net effect is to terrify people. And if they could go somewhere, they would. I mean, a lot of the people I've spoken to would quite gladly come to Britain or Ireland to go to university, to be honest, because there's not much here. But they can't go anywhere. And I think that we need to find out from the Israelis what they think they are doing. Obviously, at the border, which is only 5 kilometres, I'm sitting on the seaside, 5 kilometres inland is the border. That's Gaza. That's the full extent of Gaza.
And that's Paul Mason of Channel 4 News with that eyewitness account of recent hours in Gaza, reporting for us from there. Last year, 26,000 products on sale or heading for the shelves and deemed to be a danger to the public were destroyed on the orders of the National Consumer Agency, which publishes its annual report for last year this morning. Joining us in studio is the agency's chief executive, Karen O'Leary. Good morning. Thank you for coming in. 26,000 products, presumably not all different products, but what was in that mix?
Well, as you just mentioned, the National Consumer Agency has just published our annual report. Our job is to protect consumers by enforcing consumer law, to empower consumers with information and to represent consumers at the policy table. Part of our protection role includes a significant role in the area of product safety, most of the rules of which come from European directives, so we have some fairly strong powers in that area. As people will understand, the most effective way of ensuring that only safe products reach the shelves is to stop them at the point of entry. So we have very good relations with the customs authorities, and we would send authorised officers to the ports, and we would look at consignments to see.
So people should be comforted that you're on top of the brief, as it were. But what were you destroying last year in such large numbers?
There was a number of consignments. The sorts of items that were involved would have been low value mixed consignments, including sunglasses, soft toys, kind of unbranded but non-compliant soft toys, laser pointers, which, as you know, are quite dangerous, mobile phone chargers, which were non-compliant, mixed plugs, other chargers, other batteries. So numbers of consignments of various products.
These are the sort of things being stopped at ports that would normally perhaps not end up in a reputable shop.
Well, whether they're reputable or not, the products themselves are non-compliant. So they might end up in low-value shops and pound shops or in stalls. But ultimately, our role in product safety covers all products. So we're also part of the European-wide product rapid alert system called RAPEX. And what that means is other European countries who find unsafe products, whether they're branded or not, will notify via the RAPEX system where there's a risk.
The lasers that you bought, these are the lasers that people can point at airplanes and so on.
Exactly.
Huge dangers. Big increase in those, or what would you, how would you describe them?
Not necessarily an increase. Obviously, surveillance activity that we carry out is really important for prevention. It isn't possible to say whether that's an increase or a decrease, just that they've been found and destroyed.
And another point in the annual report, 115 enforcement actions. What typically is involved there? Not the process, but what sort of areas?
The areas we focused on during the year were unfair terms in consumer contracts in the waste sector. So we found significant breaches of consumer law with the terms of people's contracts.
So is this the bin collection company, for instance?
Exactly, yes. We also found, we did work on the e-commerce area, so obviously online purchasing is growing. And there are particular rules that businesses who operate online or who sell online need to comply with, and we did some work.
Had some success with Aer Lingus and Ryanair.
We did, yes. So we secured compliance notices, which are enforcement actions, against Aer Lingus and Ryanair for failure to have email addresses on their websites.
So this is, in other words, if I've got a problem with the booking, I have somebody to email and I can expect a response.
Exactly. The e-commerce directive means you have to, if you're involved in online purchasing or online trading, you have to have an email address.
Okay. Just two prosecutions in the whole year, and those were for clocking cars. Is that not very low for an agency with such big teeth?
Well, I think there's two issues underlying the level of prosecutions. The first thing is we have a range of enforcement powers. And what that means is we can take appropriate action depending on the nature of the breach. Some breaches are more serious than others. And also, we would seek compliance in the first instance. Where it's not forthcoming, we would then take enforcement action.
And yet they're for clocking cars. It's pretty obvious you're going to take a prosecution in that case.
Well,
they are
very serious offences, and they are criminal breaches of consumer law.
Every car clocking incident discovered resulted in a prosecution?
Not necessarily, no, because obviously for car clocking and for criminal prosecutions, it is necessary for two things to happen. Firstly, the evidence has to stack up, and sometimes not all evidence is available, or there may be an issue with the chain of ownership of the car in terms of where it has been. The other issue is, which is really important actually, is that the consumer who makes the complaint or discovers that their car may have been clocked needs to actually stay with the process. We need a witness.
Okay, so it doesn't relate to maybe resources that you have at your disposal to pursue complaints. Because for years there was an argument to give your agency or the predecessor real teeth in terms of being able to prosecute. People might be scratching their heads a little bit and saying, well, are they actually using this resource to the best effect?
I think the powers that we have are sufficiently strong to mean that very often compliance is secured simply by engagement, simply by saying, we believe there's a breach here, we want you to put it right. And because traders understand the powers that we have, they very often do that.
Okay,
so we get compliance. The ultimate issue here is to solve the problem and to achieve compliance.
What's the big issue for you this year? What are you looking at particularly? What do you want to address?
Well, we are looking at issues consumers are having in the telecoms area, particularly in relation to faulty mobile phones. As you know, there's a growth.
This is the handset or the service?
The handset.
The handset, yeah.
And interestingly, you should say that, because actually one of the features of the market in recent years has been a combination of the sale of a smartphone along with a bill pay contract. And there are competitive pressures on the industry. There are hugely beneficial deals out there for consumers. The issues we're seeing coming through our helpline and the statistics we're looking at is that consumers are very confused on their rights when something goes wrong with the phone.
Okay.
And we're looking at that area. We're engaging with the telecoms operators at the moment to see if we can solve those problems.
All right, well, very good. Listen, Karen O'Leary of the National Consumer Agency, thank you very much for coming in.
Darren is here with sport.
Rachel, a very good morning to you. It's been reported that Davy Fitzgerald has agreed to remain as manager of the Clare Hurlers until 2017. Fitzgerald agreed a 3-year extension after winning the All-Ireland last season, but the Star newspaper is reporting today that he's committed to staying an extra year. Clare were knocked out of this year's championship in the qualifiers by Wexford. He's held the position since 2011. In football news, Kevin Riley has defended Meath's decision to bring allegations of biting against a Dublin player into the public domain. The Meath camp alleged that Mickey Burke had his finger bitten during the Leinster final defeat to Dublin. The GAA Central Competitions Control Committee decided not to take any action on the matter due to insufficient evidence. The Meath captain maintains that his teammate suffered a nasty injury. Riley says his county are putting the matter behind them, but feels it's important the issue was highlighted. He's been speaking to our correspondent, Brian Carty.
You know, Mick had to spend a night in hospital getting it seen to. It was a fairly nasty injury. But again, we're not going to dwell on it. As I said, that's behind us.
And you've no doubt at all, but there was a biting incident.
Oh, it was plain to see. You know, he broke the skin on both sides of his finger. And it was a nasty enough injury.
And do you think it was handled all right by all parties concerned? Mick O'Dowd came back into the press conference again and made the allegation.
We can't condone biting. You know, tempers flare at times and things boil over and that's fine. But I think biting might be just a little bit too far, in my opinion. I think it had to be highlighted. It was dealt with by you know, both doctors, and as Mick said at the time, there is protocol to follow. Mickey Burke, you know, had to go to hospital afterwards to get it treated. But you know, both sides were quick to forget and move on and just concentrate on football.
And Meath play Armagh in the final round of the football qualifiers on Saturday. Quick Jack took the honours in the Connacht Hotel Handicap, the big race on the opening day of the Galway Racing Festival. He was a 4-1 winner for trainer Tony Martin. Dermot Well claimed one win on the opening day with Timian.
Yeah, I'm delighted too. You must remember the ground is drying out. We don't have the ammunition we've had other years, but we're very hopeful. If we get one a day, we'll be happy.
I'm joined on the line by the Racing Post, Jonathan Mullen. Jonathan, good morning to you.
Morning, Darren.
How would you reflect on the opening day there in Galway?
Yeah, I suppose there are different times, but it's not so long ago that the figures emanating from the Galway Summer Festival were used as an economic barometer. There were 19,000 there last night, 1,000 more than 2013. And both the figures from the betting ring and from Tote Ireland showed slight increases on last year. So it's a very positive start of the week, and a hugely positive one for Tony Martin, who was one of the big stories of last year's festival, really. He trained 9 winners there, including the big amateur riders handicap on day one. And last night he did it again. A brilliant training performance, really, because this is a competitive handicap. Quick Jack won it so easily. But the fact that the horse hadn't been seen on a racetrack since January, and to have him so cherry ripe for last night, shows the craft that Tony Martin brings to the game. Last year he trained a horse, Busted Tycoon, to win 3 times in the week. So I'd imagine we'd be seeing plenty more of Quick Jack later this week at Galway, where he could easily win again.
Dermot Well, just one winner, as we heard in the clip yesterday. We'll be hoping to maybe push on today. And he has a couple of runners in the big one today, the Topaz Mile, that's at 6:40.
Yeah, I mean, so much of sorting through these races at Galway, Darren, and your success otherwise in doing so is how you approach Dermot Well's runners in these big races. And the Topaz Mile today, he's got 2, Defining Year and Calibrate. Pat Smullen, currently leading the Jockeys Championship in Ireland, he's chosen Defining Year. So I think you have to give him plenty of respect. The horse was 3rd in the race a few years ago when he was at Michael Halford. He wears blinkers today for the first time. And if they can spark some improvement, he shouldn't be far away. 4 British horses in the race gives a nice international flavour today. Amazingly, only one horse ever won this race twice, Pinch Hitter back in the 80s, which is surprising given the fact that so many horses have proven themselves around Galway, come back and win again. Vastinea won 2 years ago. He was 3rd last year. He's got a big each-way chance today. But his trainer, Kevin Prendergast, who I think has won this race about 5 times, goes to Galway with an even bigger chance today in the shape of Mascoon. He's well-drawn. He's got a lightweight. And providing he breaks well, he'll be away from all the traffic trouble that inevitably comes with this big race. He's got a huge chance.
Finally, Jonathan, are you going to give our listeners this morning here on Morning Ireland a winner for the day? No
oh,
pressure
God, I
now.
Hope so. I hope so. We stick with the Topaz Mile. It's a very, very tricky handicap, so I think I'm allowed to pick two in it.
Okay.
I'm going to go with Mass Coon, who has said has been progressive this summer and looks a likely type for Kevin Prendergast. And, you know, even though Dermot Weld says he's got a weak team this year, inevitably he ends up with double-digit winners, and I think Defining Year is the other horse in the race. He's got a big chance. First-time blinkers, as I said. And don't worry, Dermot Weld, there are plenty of winners this week.
Good enough. Jonathan Mullen, thanks for taking the call this morning. Today's action at Ballybrid gets underway at 5:05. The big one there, the Topaz Mile, 6:40. And there'll be live racing coverage on RTÉ television a little later on. Also racing in the UK this afternoon, it's day one of Glorious Goodwood. It looks like Manchester United are ready to sell Marouane Fellaini. Napoli would like to sign the midfielder on a 12-month loan deal with a view to a €20 million move next summer. Javier Hernandez, Shinji Kagawa, Nani and Anderson all been linked away with moves from Old Trafford this morning. The big clear out at Southampton looks like it'll continue today. Morgan Schneiderling and Jay Rodriguez been linked with a move to Tottenham. And finally, Northern Irish boxers Paddy Barnes, Michael Conlon, Stephen Donnelly, Conor Coyle and Michaela Walsh all through to the quarterfinals at the Commonwealth Games. 20-year-old Walsh won her flyweight contest, the first ever Commonwealth women's bout.
And today in City Hall in Cork, the public are being invited to an information day on the proposed flood relief scheme being put forward by the Office of Public Works. For many years, as you know, Cork City has been hard hit by floods. Ezra McManaman is a chartered engineer with the Office of Public Works and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
Earlier this year, we saw just how bad the flooding in Cork City can get. So what is it that's going on display today?
What's going on today on display today, Rachel, is a second public consultation day. We had the first public consultation day about this time last year, but the second public consultation day today is to show people what we describe as the emerging preferred option for the solution to various flooding problems in Cork City, specifically flooding problems that arise from the River Lee and its tributaries, and also from the tide in the city area, and also from the Northern River Bride and its tributaries in the Blackpool and Commons Road and Ballyvolan area on the north side of the city.
And what then are these relief works likely to involve?
We have a scheme which we are proposing, and that scheme for flood relief purposes is made up of a package or a combination of measures. This scheme will provide protection for Cork City against flood from the river with a return period of about 100 years on average, and also a flood from the tide with a return period of 200 years on average. And that is the best international standard and practice in terms of providing flood relief defence for an urban area. I'll describe the measures to you now, and there are four elements in the package.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, we are developing a flood forecasting system which will be based on weather forecasts to give advance warning of an expected flood from either the river or the tide a number of days in advance. This will support decision making with regard to advanced discharges of water from the ESB reservoirs upstream of the city in Enniscarra and Carrickadrohid. The second measure is that there will be quite a lot of flood defences required from the Enniscarra Dam down to and through the city, and especially in the city. Those defences will provide protection against flooding both from the river and also from the tide. And you mentioned flooding earlier on in the year in February, and that was flooding that came from the tide alone in that instance. The third element of the scheme is the utilisation of lands that are already at risk of flooding, and the utilisation of those as washed lands. So those lands will be flooded by early discharges from the dams in advance of the expected flood. And finally, the last measure that I mentioned is the further optimisation of the operating procedures of the dams at Enniscarra and Carrickadrohid with a view to improving the benefit that arises from their presence for the purposes of flood risk management. The flood forecasting system that I've mentioned and the flood defences, as well as ourselves and the OPW having gone through a statutory process to put this scheme in place, will enable the ESB to discharge more water in the days in advance of an expected flood.
Right.
So that the storage facility in those reservoirs will be available to reduce the impact of the flood when it's at its worst.
Right, and just
so that damage will not be caused to build property. Sorry,
and
Richard.
Just presuming that you get the go ahead on all of this and that everything goes according to plan, you get the necessary land, etc. Mm-hmm. How long is this likely to take?
At the moment, our expectation is that the work will take about 3 to 4 years to complete. You mentioned getting the go-ahead and so on and starting the work. We have a lot of work to do yet before the work can start.
Right, and so it's likely to be a couple of years, is it, before the work can start?
No, that's what I was going to say. We are planning at the moment to award the contract to start the work by the end of next year, by the end of 2015. So that will be, as I said, awarding the contract to a contractor to start building the works necessary. So the works will probably begin then immediately in the beginning of 2016. And from then on, we expect it to take 3 to 4 years to have all of the works completed.
Okay. Ezra McManaman, thank you for joining us.
A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, but in fact, it's our planet and it's this morning and in fact, it's our territory. Filming of scenes from Star Wars is taking place on Skellig Michael this morning. Our intrepid reporter, our correspondent Pascal Sheehy is there. He's hunting the Jedi Knights for us. Good morning, Pascal. Where are you and what can you see?
Well, I'm on the pier at Knightstown on Valentia Island. It's a stunning morning, a little perhaps crisper than we've been used to for the last number of weeks, but nevertheless, you wouldn't want to be anywhere else, would you?
No, indeed you wouldn't. And I'm sure they're delighting in the scenery out there and indeed in the weather if it remains good. What do you know about what's taking place on Skellig Michael?
Well, the weather, as you mentioned it, the forecast for the afternoon is that the weather is due to deteriorate, and that forced a change to the schedule of filming today. They weren't due to begin filming until after 7 o'clock this morning. I was on the pier at Port Magee at about just before 5 o'clock this morning. It was a hive of activity at that stage with local boats and boatmen ferrying crew members across on the 12-kilometre trip from Port Magee across to Skellig Michael. And then, I suppose, the better-known and the more protected cast member, crew members and cast members, they were brought by helicopter. There's a helicopter landing and taking off from Valentia Island here on a regular basis, shuttling people out on the 10-minute trip. And I suppose they don't have to endure the threat of seasickness on that journey.
Luke Skywalker, better
protected.
Luke Skywalker doesn't have to be Luke Waterwalker then or anything like that today. But in relation to the controversy down there, in relation to the wildlife and protecting the wildlife, is that something that is of concern to local people?
I don't think so. And what local people are saying is that, look, the Office of Public Works and the department, government department, wouldn't have handed over this site to the production company for 3 days without ensuring that there were safeguards in place to protect the wildlife that are there. That's what local people are saying here. The place is absolutely abuzz that this filming is taking place here. There is a huge number of bed nights booked directly at an already busy time of the year. And notwithstanding that, they also foresee a benefit into the future as well, in so far as people coming here to see where was Star Wars Episode 7 film.
Interesting note into our copy system. One of the first duties of our new Transport Minister, Pascal Donoghue, has been to declare a 2-mile exclusion zone around the Skellig, enforced by a naval patrol vessel. Can you see the naval patrol vessel there, and are there any attempts being made to get out to the Skellig?
No, I can't see the naval patrol vessel because I'm on land at the moment. I do hope to get out closer to the island, to Skellig Michael, later on in the day. But that exclusion zone has been put in place for the duration of filming and is being enforced. That is my information at the moment. And that is for two reasons. The order actually says it's for the protection of a natural heritage area during the current filming period. It's also for safety. Skellig Michael is a dangerous place for people who are not familiar with it to go and visit. On a serious note, you know, a number of people have died there in the past. Perhaps you get one or two fatalities there every year. So it's not a place where people should be landing without the guides who normally operate in that area.
Well, Pascal Sheehy, on the coast, looking out onto the Skellige, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We hope the mood towards the naturally curious media isn't too Darth Vaderian.
Coming up between now and 9 on Morning Ireland, the UN meets while Barack Obama calls Benjamin Netanyahu to appeal for peace. We'll be assessing the latest attempts to end the violence in Gaza. Also, the Shanad is recalled to discuss the crises in the Middle East and Ukraine. The frightening spread of Ebola in West Africa. Why birdwatchers aren't happy with the news that Star Wars is coming to Skellig Michael. And in sport, Darren will be reflecting on the weekend's big matches.
Just coming up to 8 o'clock on Monday the 28th of July on RTE Radio 1. This is Morning Ireland with Rachel English and Christopher McKevitt.
In the news headlines, Israeli and Palestinian diplomats have criticised a statement issued by the UN Security Council. A storage tank containing more than 6 million litres of fuel has caught fire in the Libyan capital Tripoli. And back home, 100 jobs are to be provided at a Dublin-based information technology company. With the news in detail, here's Brian Jennings.
The United Nations Security Council has called for an immediate and unconditional humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza, coinciding with the Muslim festival of Eid, which marks the end of Ramadan. Earlier, President Obama spoke by telephone to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and stressed the need for a cessation of fighting. The President of the UN Security Council, Rwanda's Ambassador Eugene Richard Gasana, urged all sides to accept and implement a truce so as to allow urgent aid to reach civilians.
The Security Council calls for full respect of international humanitarian law, including the protection of civilian population, and reiterates the need to take appropriate steps to ensure the safety and well-being of civilians and their protection.
The Palestinian ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, said the Security Council should have gone further.
So what we've seen after 20 days from the Security Council is a presidential statement that is not a resolution. They should have adopted a resolution long time ago to condemn this aggression and to call for this aggression to be stopped immediately, to provide the Palestinian people with protection and to lift the siege against our people in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli ambassador to the UN, Ron Prosser, said the statement should have mentioned Israel's right to defend itself.
I want to speak as the voice of reason to the citizens of the world who need to hear the unvarnished truth. We did everything we could to avoid this conflict. But Hamas refused to stop the attacks. Israel agreed to 5 ceasefire proposals. Hamas rejected or broke all of them, even the ones that they requested by themselves. Every single time the international community called for a ceasefire, we seized and Hamas fired.
More than 1,000 Palestinians, mainly of whom were civilians, including children, have been killed in the 20-day conflict. Israel says 43 of its soldiers have died, along with 3 civilians. A storage tank containing more than 6 million litres of fuel has caught fire during fighting between rival militias in the Libyan capital Tripoli. The government has called for an immediate truce in the area to allow firefighters to work unhindered. It has also appealed for international help to tackle the fire. Back home, a report today contends that the amount of taxes and cuts needed in recent years was greatly increased by the decision of successive governments to protect those on social welfare. The report by the Economic and Social Research Institute also says that the bulk of the burden of tax increases has been carried by those on middle incomes. Justin McCarthy reports.
The years since the bursting of the property bubble have involved a painful adjustment for everyone, but according to the ESRI, the policy of successive governments to protect those who are dependent on social welfare has contributed to an outcome where inequality in the distribution of income has actually fallen over the past 5 years. It says maintaining the social welfare system in the face of a massive increase in numbers depending on it meant that the need for increased taxes and cuts elsewhere in the economy was greatly increased. Ireland, it says, differed from other EU countries where the gap between the richest and poorest increased significantly as a result of the crisis. The ESRI says that because of the policy decisions taken here and because of a large reduction in the number of high earners, the bulk of the burden of tax increases had to be carried by those on middle incomes.
100 jobs are to be provided at a Dublin-based information technology company, Version One. It follows an €8 million investment in the company by the government-supported BDO Development Capital Fund. The investment will also enable Version One's further expansion into the UK. A man has died and 8 other people are being treated in hospital after being struck by lightning in Los Angeles. They were all caught in a thunderstorm at Venice Beach. Another man was injured while playing golf on Catalina Island nearby. Now the time is 8:05. The weather forecast, it'll be mostly cloudy this morning with showers over the eastern half of the country. It'll become generally dry with sunny spells as the day goes on. Highest temperatures will range from 18 to 21 degrees.